Hello and welcome to another preview podcast exclusively for you guys here on Patreon. As always, I'm joined by Lewis Ambrose. Hello, Lewis.
Hello, Andrew. How's it going?
It's going all right. I just want to make one thing very clear for everybody listening to this right now. Preview podcasts for the Europa League group stage games are not going to be a thing. We're not going to do those as a rule because, you know, what can you say about, I've forgotten who's in our group, FC Zurich, our Norwegian friends,
Bodo Glimt,
and the other one. Who's the other
PSV,
one?
PSV,
yeah.
Eindhoven.
Ruud van Nistelrooy, I forgot all about him. But look, yeah, we're not going to do them for the group stage. Obviously, when the competition gets a bit more interesting and intense, we'll probably do preview podcasts for those. But given that we didn't do anything midweek, and given that the 30 didn't go out this week, I jumped at the chance when you texted me earlier on going, preview podcast today? So here we are.
Yeah, you're telling people now we're not going to do one, but we'll be scrambling when on match day 5 it's do or die and we have to get a result, and suddenly we're all glued to our televisions because the game means so much.
Gabriel Jesus starting in the Europa League. No, hopefully not. Hopefully not. We will talk Europa League. I mean, we don't know too much right now. We'll get to it because Mikel Arteta is going to meet the press in Zurich or St. Gallen.
Because they're not playing in Zurich, right?
Yeah, they're not playing there because there's like athletics on. You think they might have sorted that kind of shit out beforehand.
Wouldn't you imagine that when they were coming up with the fixtures that they would just say that Zurich would play the first game away from home? If they can't play in their own stadium this week.
Yeah. Maybe they were just, you know, maybe Zurich were just so confident of getting into the Champions League that they said, this Thursday shit, that's not for us. We're not going to have any part of the Thursday nonsense. It'll be Tuesday and Wednesday for us. And then, obviously, that didn't happen. We'll come to that, though. There are a couple of things we should probably talk about. And first and foremost is, I suppose, the big news from a Premier League point of view is the departure of Thomas Tuchel from Chelsea. What a sweet reunion that was for Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and his former coach.
Was it one training session and 60 minutes in a defeat to Dinamo Zagreb?
While he's got a broken jaw. And
then he's gone again already. Good luck to him and whoever he's being coached by, I guess. That was a laugh this morning. I didn't see any of the Chelsea game yesterday. When I have seen Chelsea this season, no, they've been rubbish.
Yeah, I didn't see it either.
But then I did see an interview that Tuchel did with BT Sport by Archie Rintoul, who you've had on the Ask Us before, and I've met a few times. And it doesn't usually happen the very next morning, but it did smack of being one of those interviews where the guy's asking to be sacked. It just looked like he had no ideas. And I think Archie asked him at some point, you know, the goal looked like it completely crushed the spirits of your players.
Right.
And Tuchel went, I can't argue with that. if you think it looked like that, I guess it did. Bizarre. He's been moaning since preseason, hasn't he? He went off for one when we beat them in preseason about the players not being good enough and not having enough of a squad. They only spent the most money in the entire Premier League this summer. So
Goodness knows. It is a bit mad because like he was complaining about the lack of transfer activity, and I'm sure that Chelsea were planning on doing stuff anyway, but after he made that complaint, they really went completely crazy in the transfer market. They signed I don't know how many fucking players and spent I don't know how much fucking money, right? So it's a bit of a mad one. I know, did you see the interview that was doing the rounds on Twitter today, where could have been Sky Sports, something like that, where they're talking about his relationship with the new owners? And he said, well, they've never owned a football club before. And she said, hey, are you teaching them about football? And he said, yeah, maybe, but don't tell them that, you know. So, I mean, the idea that these guys have come in and don't have a fucking clue what they're doing.
And then got rid of everybody.
I mean, Petr Cech is gone. I can't remember.
Granovskaya.
Yeah, she's gone. They just let go of the head of recruitment as well.
Wouldn't you have kept hold of all of those people for the summer and then maybe figured out along what you're going to do afterwards? I mean, some of the articles today, obviously, you know, whenever a manager gets sacked, we always get the articles that obviously drip out of the club. And some of them today were basically admitting that Tuchel was being asked about football by the man who was then flying around Europe making bids for players. Oh, should we bid for this guy? It said that Todd Bowley was upset, and when Tuchel was adamant, he didn't want him to bid for Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah.
But what do you mean? You're asking the guy who works in football, and you've just stepped into football, and then you're trying to tell him who you should target. And I think Tuchel is not, you got that from his time at Dortmund, and then obviously he was at PSG after that as well. He doesn't seem to be the sort of guy like maybe Arteta and the old school Wenger and Ferguson. He doesn't seem to want to be involved in all of those discussions and all of that. Yeah, I think he wants to coach.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. And you know, I've said this before in the last couple of weeks. I'm reading / listening to the Carlo Ancelotti book where he's talking about leadership. And he made a really good point in it where he's basically saying that unless you're there as part of a project, as coach, you shouldn't really have too much to do with recruitment, right? You should say, we need this type of player for this position. We need that type of player for that position, blah, 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 blah. But like the thing has got to come from... you know, the club itself.
All of the departments that Todd Bowley sacked.
Exactly, all the people that Todd Bowley got rid of and replaced with Todd Bowley. You know, this is what you should do. And he actually cited Martin Odegaard as an example of this, where he said, you know, Real Madrid, they signed a 15-year-old kid from Norway, but I'm not interested in that because I'm not going to be here when he's ready for first team football. So it's not that he's dismissing Martin Odegaard. It's like, you know, this means nothing to me because he is not going to be in my team. And I think to an extent, that's what Tuchel is, the way he's operated. I mean, the stories where he's like, he wasn't particularly active in the WhatsApp group. You know, I don't know how many WhatsApp groups you're in, but like quite often I read them and go like, oh, I've got nothing to say here. I really don't have anything.
You're not busy training a football team.
Well, that's it. Yeah, trying to get this disparate group of players. Like, who are all these people that you brought in? Like, I'd love to know to what extent the recruitment was informed by what Thomas Tuchel said he wanted / needed. Like, you know, he would have left it to the club to get the players, the individuals. I'm sure he'll have some kind of input. But did he say, go get me an ancient centre-half because we've got an ancient centre-half that needs to be replaced?
Well, and you let's know, spend 60 million on a left-back because we've already got a first-choice left-back.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. I'm not 100% sure that the strategy, such as it was, came from Thomas Tuchel. And like, it must be really weird when you spent your entire life in football as a manager, as a head coach, you know, like you say, he was at Dortmund. I don't know where he was before Dortmund.
Mainz.
And then to PSG, and then to Chelsea, where he's won the Champions League for Chelsea. And then all of a sudden, I don't know, it's just like somebody coming along who doesn't know anything about the industry that you work in and deciding how things are going to go. I'd say it's a bit like soul destroying. That's the word I was looking for.
Good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I'm glad. And like the potential for Chelsea to be an absolute shit show / hilarious comedy, ongoing comedy. Welcome to season 3 of Chelsea, the greatest comedy that anyone's ever seen. It's high, isn't it? Because if this is the way this owner is going to operate, like a lot of coaches, whether it's Graham Potter, who they're talking to now, apparently, or anybody else, you know, they're going to find that kind of shit really difficult to deal with.
Yeah, it's a weird squad now. It's a weird team. They don't really have any central midfielders. So Jorginho and Kovacic, obviously, but other than that, there's not really anyone there. They got rid of Lukaku and Werner, and then panicked and got Aubameyang on deadline day, knowing that he already had a relationship with the manager and had played really well for the manager before. So then you're left with him. Kai Havertz is hard to define what he is. Is he a striker? Probably not. Mm. Is he an attacking midfielder? Not really. I mean, Raheem Sterling's walked into this absolute mess as well. He's walked away from the Premier League champions and, you know, apparently wasn't interested in possibly talking to Arsenal if we were even interested in him because we weren't in the Champions League. And like, is it really better to play Champions League football for 1 year or for half a season, and then you're stuck for the next 3 or 4 years of a contract with whatever the fuck Chelsea are going to be.
Yeah.
There's a lot of it. A lot of these players, you know, 70 million on Fofana, was it? They've all made decisions. I mean, they've not made decisions to sign for Chelsea based on conversations with Todd Boehly. I'm sure Tuchel has spoken to all of them and convinced them to join the club.
Maybe.
And Todd Boehly's obviously written a number on a piece of paper, and the number's done some of the talking for them. But it's difficult now, like, to imagine, even if they make a really good appointment, it's great. It's hard to imagine Chelsea having a good season. And it feels like it's going to take a while for them to figure stuff out.
Yeah, look, I don't think they will figure it out under this owner, which is quite funny. I mean, you know, obviously, when they have discussions with a new manager, with someone like Graham Potter, who's done a very good job at Brighton, there's no two ways about it, right? He's done a very good job there. And he is going to come in and say, look, if I take this job, this is the way it's got to work for me. You know, this is the way I work. This is the way I'm going to run the team. This is the way blah, 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 which is all well and good until the guy who actually owns the club starts getting a bit itchy about getting involved, because clearly he wants to be front and center of this new Chelsea, doesn't he?
Why is he trying to pick transfer targets and asking the manager if he thinks it's a good idea? It's just someone else's job.
Yeah.
There were people who had that job at Chelsea and he got rid of them and then decided that he'd try it this summer. It's amazing. It's just a bored American billionaire, it felt like, deciding that he wanted to fly around to a bunch of European cities and just make bids for players while he was there. It'd be nice to go see Barcelona for a few days.
Sure.
Might as well bid for Aubameyang while we're there. It was weird. It was a weird, weird summer. And it's got a bit weirder because I don't think Chelsea have looked good at all this season. And I don't think, even at the weekend, I think they got very lucky to get away with all 3 points.
Yeah.
With that goal being disallowed right at the end for West Ham. But to ask a manager now to come in when the transfer window's just shut and you've just spent all this money, to ask someone to come in and say, you're now stuck with this weird pick a mix of a squad and we want you to do better than the guy who won the Champions League was doing. I don't think Tuchel ever did a fantastic job, to be honest. I think in terms of building something long-term, the Champions League maybe even held him back a bit because it meant keeping hold of players because they'd won them the Champions League that maybe it would have been helpful for Chelsea to move on from. And that turnovers maybe been a little bit slower, and then this summer they're all over the place. Barcelona were desperate to sign Cesar Azpilicueta, who's old and rubbish and finished. Why were Chelsea so desperate to keep him around for another year? I just don't get it. I don't get. Imagine when we've been stuck with older players before, David Luiz or Willian. Like if somebody came along for them, we'd have burned their hands off when they all look like they're past their best, and you can't get rid of them for love nor money. And here they are pushing Barcelona away and then going and giving them 12 million for a player that was available for free in January.
And then spending, the guts of 100 million on two players, you know, to play one at centre-half. I don't know how much they paid for Koulibaly as well on top of that. So I'm thinking Fofana, Koulibaly and Cucurella. Like, how much fucking money did they spend? And it renders Azpilicueta basically not useless, but he's sort of not really as important as he might have been. I could understand them hanging on to him in the summer, you know, because like Christensen had gone, Rudiger had gone, everything was up in the air. Nobody knew quite what was happening. We've got to like maintain some kind of a defense here. But look, I think the main point and the thing that we should underline here is that the worse things get for Chelsea, the funnier it is for all of us. And we have to hope that that continues.
Yeah, and who knows? Maybe we'll be looking back in a month saying Thomas Tuchel was holding things together and it's going to get a hell of a lot worse.
Oh, that'd be lovely. Please.
I tell you, I don't think that's an attractive job to walk into when you don't know if Boehly gets around to appointing some sort of sporting director, you don't know who it's going to be. You've got no idea if you're going to get along with the guy or what he's going to think about how to build a squad. And you're walking into a club who have a game that you'd expect them to win. They've gone and lost the opening game of the Champions League group stage, and now it's probably looking a lot harder than you'd have thought to get out the group. So it's an absolute mess. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, you can understand.
It's great to not be that club.
Yes, that is true. And you can understand why Graham Potter would go for it, because A, I'm sure, you know, the chance to manage a big club, in inverted commas, big club, everyone knows what I'm talking about, Chelsea, is, you know, you can see why he would go for it. He gets to manage in the Champions League, gets, I'm sure, a significant salary. And if it doesn't go well, you know, he can always walk away from that and go, you know, it's Chelsea. Like, they're fucking nuts. It's not my fault. They're just fucking bananas. So anyway, let's put Chelsea to one side. I didn't want to ask you a little bit about Bernd Leno and some comments that he made, which are doing the rounds. And I'm not quite sure how accurate all the translations are, but basically, what I have up here in front of me is, I can't fucking find it now. Leno, when I realized that it wasn't about performance or quality, I knew I had to go. In preparation, and I think that means preseason, right? I saw that it's not about performance, but only politics. It was clear to me. I had to get out of there. And, for, you know, if it's about politics, I think we can all understand why he would want to get out of there. Nobody wants to be involved in a conservative leadership campaign or anything close to that. but these were remarks made in an interview with Bild. I don't know if you've seen the full thing or, you know, what exactly he said. Is it being slightly misrepresented?
Yeah, so I just, knowing that we were recording and seeing people freak out on Twitter, I finished work and I just ran around to the supermarket closest to me, and I did what you shouldn't do and grabbed it off the shelves and then just read the bit that I wanted to read and then put it back. But I also don't want Sport Bild to get any of my money because, you know,
okay,
essentially that's the German version of the Sun, if you like.
Right.
So those are the quotes we've all seen, and this is an interview that's been done. And this is really common in Germany. So Sport Bild is obviously the newspaper, the daily newspaper everyone knows about. And Sport Bild is, I think, a weekly or maybe twice a week magazine. Mm. So you get articles that come out in the magazine in print, but then they don't put the whole article online. Or they do, but it's behind a paywall. Or it's behind a paywall when it's 24 hours later than the print version went out.
Sure.
And selected quotes are obviously released to sell copies, and people will pick up those quotes. And that's what we've seen today with the quotes that you just mentioned. So I went around and I had a quick look and I took a quick picture. I'm going to translate on the fly here in case anything sounds clunky. But yeah, so there's in that answer that you just read out to the question, he was asked, when was it clear to you that it didn't make any sense to stay at Arsenal anymore? And the answer you've just read out is the answer he gives, but there's a chunk in the middle missing that hasn't been released.
Oh, funny that.
It's a chunk that mentions Matt Turner. So obviously the ambiguity has caused this entire shit stirring because people think, oh, is he talking about Ramsdale? Is he saying that Ramsdale was rubbish and he never should have been first choice? No, Bernd Leno said, as I realized it wasn't about quality, performance or quality, it was obvious to me that I had to go. On top of that came Matt Turner, the goalkeeper out of the US, who was going to be made number two, which certainly looks good in terms of marketing. Then in pre-season, I saw that it wasn't about performance, but about politics, and it was clear to me I need to get out of here. So, you know, that whole chunk about it being Matt Turner and it being, you know, I think the fact that he explicitly mentions Turner and the fact that he's American and then marketing, I think it's pretty obvious what Bernd Leno thinks about Matt, not maybe about Matt Turner's quality, but about why Arsenal have signed Matt Turner and why Arsenal wanted to make him number two.
I mean, look, if he's talking about politics, you know, it's like, well, the new guy is going to get the nod over me anyway. You know, when you bring in a new goalkeeper like that, I think everyone kind of knew Bernd Leno would be leaving at some point.
With 1 year left on his Arsenal contract.
Yeah, exactly. It's a strange sort of thing. And like the idea that players as marketing tools is always not really sat particularly well with me. You know, when Arsenal signed Junichi Inamoto from Japan, it was like, well, you know, they're doing it so they can sell shirts in Japan. And like same with Ju Young Park, they're doing it so they can sell shirts in Korea. And I'm thinking, how many fucking shirts do you think they need to sell to make any kind of money? Because like the kit deals, for example, you know, the sales go to retailers Arsenal don't really make a great deal. I don't know if Arsenal or any football club makes anything on sales of shirts that happen in JD Sports or Champion Sports or whatever it is. You know, they might make money on the shirts that are sold in the Armory, but, you know, general retail sales, I don't think they get anything for those because it's wrapped up in the deal that they already... So Adidas will say, here's fucking £60 million a season. Yeah. We're going to sell your kit. It doesn't matter if you sell 10 trillion fucking shirts in South Korea because Chu Young Park is one of your players. It's not really... it doesn't really work that way.
I have no doubt that it's... I wouldn't say that it definitely doesn't come into the equation. I've no doubt that it's good for Arsenal to think, oh, if this guy turns into a Japanese superstar,
sure,
then we're going to be the number one club in Japan, and that's going to be great for business and money that it might bring in. Mm. But to sign a backup goalkeeper and then claim that it's all about politics and the marketing power of the world famous 500 million followers on Instagram, Matt Turner, I think is, you know, pie in the sky. And, you know, the next question in the interview, Leno was asked, and I think some of those quotes have gone around as well, was asked about being made to train on his own and during the US tour and not getting on the pitch during the US tour. He was demanding to leave the club at that point. Like, you're going to let him train with the team? We played Fulham a few weeks after he was sold. Do you want him training with the team and seeing all of the details maybe for match preparation and stuff like that? You know, I don't think it is odd that, you know, that Matt Turner was preparing to play for Arsenal this season, and he was the guy who got the minutes on the tour, and he was the guy that was being focused on and training, and that Leno wasn't really a part of that. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's weird for Leno not to just say, I wasn't playing and it was a good move for me. We got to stay in London where we're really comfortable and stay in the Premier League, and now I can play every week and, you know, fight for my place in the Germany team or whatever.
Yeah.
I thought that would have been just a very normal, sensible answer. I don't know if there's a little bit of bargaining with himself, telling himself that it was his choice and that he was still fighting to be Arsenal number one, but that was taken out of his hands cruelly. Maybe, which I can understand as well if he sort of talked himself into that narrative. But yeah, the quotes were a bit odd for me. And when bits and pieces of interviews are obviously released for a reason online to create this furore around them, and especially when they've been done in another language, they always have to be taken with a pinch of salt.
Yeah. Matt Turner's got 124,000 followers on Instagram, by the way.
He could fill the Emirates twice. That's amazing.
Well, I mean, that's it. If you could get them all, you know, over there. But I'm not sure that that's going to work. Like, it is quite a cynical observation. You know, I get Arsenal are American owned. I think Bernd Leno is probably a better goalkeeper than Matt Turner. That said, I haven't seen Matt Turner. And I, what do you think about the implication, I guess, that he's making is that Arsenal signed this goalkeeper just to sort of connect with American fans or just to sort of keep the American owners happy, and that it's not really about the quality of the player, it's about those other things. What do you think about that? Because, you know, maybe there's something to it, maybe there isn't. I'm really... what's the word? Skeptical of the idea that we would sign a goalkeeper on that basis when we know it's an important role, even if it's, you know, not one, a player who may not play a great deal, but you do need a competent number two goalkeeper. And given that we already went through the Alex Runarsson debacle, if you want to call it that, the idea that we're just signing another guy who could be like as bad as he is, that doesn't really make any sense to me.
No, I mean, do we think that Arsenal sign players that Mikel Arteta doesn't sign off on, and that Mikel Arteta would happily play players that he doesn't believe are going to get Arsenal points or wins as well? So I've obviously watched MLS. I watch enough football without staying up until 3 a.m. watching MLS, I think. But John Mueller, who now writes for The Athletic, did a piece a couple of years ago for, I think, 538.
Right.
And if you take expected goals and post-shot expected goals, so not just where the shot's taken from, but how hard and how accurately it's been hit, and then figure out backwards from there how many goals you'd expect a goalkeeper to concede. Matt Turner is the best goalkeeper in the history of MLS. I think there's lots of questions and doubt that he's good with his feet, but the data, at least, and we know that Arsenal use data now, like all the clubs now, when they're pursuing players. I'll find the link to the article for the show notes if you want. But the article spells out that Matt Turner was as of a year, 18 months ago, the best shot stopper in MLS history since this data existed.
Right.
So I find it very hard to believe that Bert Leno's watched a couple of training sessions and then decided that this guy is absolutely rubbish. I don't think Matt Turner is going to compete with Aaron Ramsdale for number one. Mm. And I think there are fairly questions about how good he is with his feet. Mm. And we'll see. I'm looking forward to seeing over the course of the Europa League group stage and maybe the League Cup as well, how comfortable he looks and how well he performs. Mm. And we'll see and learn a lot more about him. But to think that, like to mention Runarsson as you did, to think that Arsenal signed somebody like that just to try and, I don't know, get a few people in America supporting the club, as if Americans can't watch the Premier League all the time anyway and then decide for themselves if they want to follow a particular club or not. Yeah. It's just nonsense, obviously.
Well, I mean, the two things I will just say that there's a 99.9% chance that I'm a 538 skeptic based on some of the stuff they put out in the past. The other thing, of course, is that Arsenal's marketing push in Iceland was a complete failure in signing Alex Runarsson. So maybe they're just learning their lessons on this. Speaking of Matt Turner, though, and let's turn our attention very briefly to the actual game of football we have tomorrow. Do you think he's going to start against FC Zurich?
I think he will. I think, especially after Ramsdale went down holding his hamstring a couple of weeks ago against Fulham. I think there's that element of balance with these games where you want to put out a team that's competitive and you don't want to slip up and have egg on your face by the end of it. But you also do need to give players a chance and keep them fresh in case. Mm. It's not just Matt Turner, it's in a whole host of positions. It's up front with Eddie Nketiah. Gabriel Jesus could pick up an injury and be out for a while, and so could Aaron Ramsdale. So you don't want their replacements coming in completely cold if that does happen in the Premier League games. So I think it's important to give those guys time on the pitch and on the other hand, give a rest to other players as well, Ramsdale being one of them, Jesus being another one.
Yeah.
I think your thoughts on Cedric Suarez are well documented and well known. But yeah, I was going to say it's for the one time in his Arsenal career that we've all probably wanted him to start a game. Yeah. And it sounds like he's out.
Yeah, he's out. According to Charles Watts, Arsenal have brought a strong squad to Switzerland, which is understandable because it isn't the deepest squad. So we don't have Thomas Partey. We don't have Emile Smith Rowe because he's injured. We don't have Cedric. There is an interesting aspect to this season's Europa League group stage campaign. Is like, who are the kids that are going to bolster the squad? Who are the players who are going to come in and maybe take their chances? You could think about Marquinhos. Is this a game where he could start and Bukayo Saka doesn't? I mean, I hope that's the case. Let's have a look at Marquinhos. Let's see what he's made of, and let's make sure that we rest Bukayo Saka. People like...
You're right, though. It's a big squad. Some of those guys, Saka or Martinelli, Jesus, one or two of those are probably going to have to start or play a significant amount of the game still.
Yeah, I mean, what are we going to do in the centre of midfield? Sambi could start again, but do you keep playing Martin Odegaard? I mean, I suppose we're going to see Fabio Vieira, who had an interesting cameo in the Manchester United game. I'm not sure to what extent you studied that game, how well you were able to watch it, given your weekend of carousing. In the Emerald Isle, but
we were watching the game.
It's not about watching it. It's about what kind of state you were in to understand and to parse the things that you were seeing with your eyes with a belly full of Guinness. You know,
probably not as good a state as I told myself I was in. So I came away from the game with very clear and strong opinions that I maybe ought not to have had. But I did think Vieira looked quite interesting, yeah. Looked lively when in his, I know it was maybe a bit too long to call it a cameo. Was it about 25 minutes, half an hour?
About 20 minutes, 20? I think.
20 minutes?
I think 20 minutes.
Yeah, but I thought it was interesting. And I also thought making that sub that early was maybe even done in mind that you wanted to start him on Thursday, and maybe giving him 5 minutes ahead of a start wasn't quite enough.
Right.
I wondered at the time if that was maybe a part of it, a part of gung-ho and just throwing him on for that much of a debut at Old Trafford. So, but I'm sure we'll see him.
74 minutes those subs were made.
Okay.
Like, does that fit into your definition of a cameo? Like, what is a cameo, and then what becomes an appearance? When does a cameo become an appearance?
For the sake of me being right, I'm just going to say 15 minutes is the cutoff point.
15 minutes. Okay. So you're 16 minutes. So it is just very slightly too long for a cameo. Okay. Well done. You've set the boundaries yourself and proved yourself right. That's very good. I mean, he did look good. I thought he looked quite lively. Did you say lively? I mean, I think there was one pass with his left foot towards Martinelli, which was like...
Which very nearly got in, yeah.
Very tasty. Very
that was good. Yeah, I thought he looked busy. I think, yeah, and it's to be expected. Premier League debut, Old Trafford. He looked a little bit lightweight, but also at the same time not afraid of throwing himself into challenges, not shirking away from things, and the responsibility to get on the ball. If we wanted to compare, and I think maybe would maybe be a little bit unfair, but I think he was a lot more involved than Emile Smith Rowe, who has a lot more experience and we know as a player that we know a lot more about already. So I imagine we'll see him from the start. Maybe Marquinhos. We've obviously got Tomiyasu, Tierney and Rob Holding who can come in at the back. Yeah. So there can be maybe a little bit more rotation in defence than there will be further forward. Yeah, it'll be an interesting one. I think being the first match day and away from home, it's a really good one as well. You can, if we get off to a good start, and maybe that could be a reason for a bit less rotation. If we win this one, then you think, well, we've only got to win the three home games and you're through already. So
yeah,
maybe you go a little bit stronger with that in mind. But I would be very surprised, having lost at the weekend, especially if Mikel Arteta didn't have one eye on Sunday in Everton.
Well, for sure. And I was just looking at the fixtures, and I think what's interesting, with all due respect to our Swiss and Norwegian listeners, perhaps PSV Eindhoven is the most difficult of the two group stage opponents. And we play Brentford away after PSV, and then after PSV at home, or PSV away rather, we play Nottingham Forest at home. PSV, I think, away is our second last group stage game. So maybe for those games, you might see him strengthen out the starting 11 to ensure the team is a bit more competitive. But for one like this, you assume there's going to be a lot of changes because, like you say, we've got to bounce back from defeat. We don't want to talk too much about Everton because we've got to do a preview podcast about that as well. But yeah, I think it's going to be a fairly changed side for tomorrow night.
Yeah, and get off to a good start and you're in a great position. Mm. And even if we didn't play particularly well and drew the game, then you've got five games to make up for it. So
yeah,
it's no disaster, the opening group game of a European campaign. So I think that'll be in Mikel Arteta's mind that, in general, in the Europa League, I expect him to go really strong. We've seen him in previous seasons, even as Arsenal fans and having gotten so used to Arsene Wenger's approach, we see Mikel Arteta go really strong comparatively in the League Cup as well. So
yeah.
I don't think there's any competition that he'll take lightly. At the same time, you've got five extra games, so it's not a straight knockout. You can always make up for it.
Mm.
And I has got to be on Sunday, I think, and stay on top of the league after Sunday's result.
All right. Well, look, we will leave it there. We'll see what happens. Obviously, we'll get more from Mikel Arteta when he meets the press this evening in Switzerland, which is due to take place in about 90 minutes time, that press conference. So we'll cover all the bits and pieces on Ars Blog News and in the blog tomorrow. And hopefully we can get our Europa League campaign off to a good start. For now, though, Lewis, thank you very much as always. And we will talk to you on Friday as we look ahead to Everton.
Speak to you then.
And to you guys here on Patreon, thank you very much as always. And we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.